Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have David Stroop, lecturer in Chinese politics at the University of Manchester, and he'll be talking about his new book, Pure and True, The Everyday Politics of Ethnicity for China's Hui Muslims, which was published this year, 2022, by the University of Washington Press. It hopefully goes without saying at this point that Islam in China is a concern whose reach extends well beyond that country's borders. The mass detention of mostly Turkic Muslim residents of Xinjiang is no longer an obscure topic, even to those without a deep interest in Chinese or Islamic affairs. And as a result, the Uyghur and Kazakh people who have been the primary victims of Beijing's Strike Hard campaign have also become better known. But the history and contemporary identity of the largest single group of Chinese Muslims is less understood outside the country, even if in the present moment it's coming under a similar pressure from those same party state campaigns. The Hui are near ubiquitous across China, with notable communities in most provinces and in both the countryside and the cities, where enclaves have long existed, centered on mosques and clusters of halal butchers and restaurants. It's in these latter urban environments that David Stroop's new book goes looking for the complex negotiations of ethnic, religious, class, and other identities that face Hui today. A multi-sited project based on dozens of interviews and ethnographic observation in the cities of Jinan, Yinchuan, Beijing, and Xining, this clearly written and persuasive book explores a number of the key areas of everyday Hui political life, from food and dress to marriage and language. Through the lens of these issues, Stroop shows us how people's day-to-day understandings of Hui-ness intersect with the categories put forward by the state, and how grand-scale processes such as urbanization and migration spark more intimate and local debates which unfold within Hui communities. But to discuss these and other aspects of this excellent book on multiple scales, the author's here to say more, so I'll say David Stroop, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, and I'm really glad to be here.
Well, yes, and I should say that unusually for a recording of this nature, we're sitting only a few hundred meters away from one another in Manchester. So it's a unique and novel experience for me, as well as an excellent book to have read. But before we get into the book itself, I'll ask you to say a few things about your academic background, how you came to be interested in Islam in China, and indeed to write this book.
Sure. So I think that like many people who enter into area studies or area studies adjacent work, my interest in China is very much a combination of personal experience and lived experience in the field that kind of bring me to an interest in the topic. So when I was an undergraduate at Davidson College, I kind of decided to study China because of a really excellent seminar class taught by Shelley Rigger, who is, you know, of course, the fantastic scholar of Taiwanese politics, who was teaching then a seminar on Chinese politics. And sort of after that class, it sort of really galvanized me to learn Chinese language and study China and Chinese politics and also study abroad in China. And so after 6 months of study abroad in Yunnan, where multiculturalism and ethnic diversity were constant subjects of conversation in our seminars and in our trips into the field, and after also living with a Hui family, homestay family during this time, I was very familiar with the idea that China was a big, vibrant, and diverse country with lots of different people who comprised the Chinese state. And I was really interested with these questions about how people who were not part of the Han majority really fit into this multicultural project that was the Chinese nation, the Chinese state. And I kind of wanted to examine how both economic development was changing those roles for ethnic minorities, and how cultural preservation was a thing that was being sort of practiced in political and social terms. And as I continued to just become more familiar with China, these questions continued to loom larger and larger. After undergrad, I took a year in the field just working in China, trying to sort of increase my familiarity with the country. I didn't think that I was fully prepared to go jump in, study China from a graduate perspective, a graduate degree perspective, without having a little bit more lived experience. And I took a year in Jinan, a city that would eventually become one of my field sites. I really felt that, you know, I was continuing to encounter these questions. And so I really, by the time I got to a grad school position at the University of Oklahoma, where I did my graduate studies, so it would be my PhD, I was pretty convinced that the thing that I really wanted to study in Chinese politics was to understand how political institutions of the state interacted with all of these diverse and different people. And I was really interested in the way that the Hui friends that I had made in both in Yunnan and in Jinan sort of fit into this picture of identity. And I really decided that my studies needed to be sort of focused on understanding that puzzle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. I just wonder, did you have anything relating to your kind of own US context or background in mind when you were learning about these things? I sometimes wonder if, you know, these sort of formative experiences, study abroad and other kinds of fieldwork experiences in other countries, bring to the four concerns which one might learn about, you know, at an early stage of life in any setting. But it just happens that if you're in China, these questions of ethnic politics emerge in a Chinese perspective. Like, how much would you say there was something comparative in your head about how these things might play out in China compared to the United States?
I think the ways in which ethnic identity in particular is so categorized and legally encoded in ways that they are not in the US, where identification is very much a voluntary experience and it's just sort of an open-ended question. When you are experienced in living and growing up in the United States and then comparing that to China, those two very different ways of self-identification, it can't help but be a comparative point of reference, even if it's not primarily salient in your mind. So I think in some senses, you know, that's always going to be something that you consider as you understand and identify these things. As I've continued to study and as I have grown increasingly familiar, you know, throughout the course of my education and through fieldwork experience and everything else, I think the points of comparison become more and more interesting. So in particular, studying Islam in China in these days, and this is something maybe we can talk about towards the end, the points of reference between how Islamic experience, Islamic identity in the United States is experienced by American Muslims and how it's experienced by Chinese Muslims is obviously a relevant point of comparison for today.
Mm-hmm. And it's always helpful, I think, if these kinds of studies can lead to a denaturalization of one's own context. But that's great, anyway, to hear a bit about those kind of embodied or on the ground experiences that led you to this topic, in a sense. And I'm, you know, as a by background, not in politics, but to read something that has so much ethnographic richness and sense of place is, you know, perhaps in one's own kind of prejudiced and narrow-minded view from the outside of what political science might be, very refreshing to encounter. So we'll get into the book itself, I think. Now, you introduced the Hui as a community and in some of your own fieldwork experiences in the introduction. But it's kind of, I think, intriguing how you set this up, particularly with a reference to the relationship between the Hui community and the state at large in terms of conflict, a history of conflict or resistance or rebellion, and a present day, which I think you it's fair to say you characterize as more sort of Pacific, more at peace and perhaps, you know, in a relationship of relative calm, at least perhaps until recent days, with the central state. So why is that a particular framing that you wanted to draw attention to? What is this history of a kind of uneasy relationship? And why is it relevant to the contemporary status that you highlight there?
I think it's always important to kind of understand where the historical roots of the present day lie. And especially when we talk about relationships between the Hui and the Chinese state, whether it's the current PRC or various other state projects that have occurred throughout modern or contemporary history, there is that legacy of contentiousness that lies just beneath the surface. And this is something that, you know, people in, especially in Northwest China, where a lot of the contentious politics around Islamic rebellions happened in the 18th and 19th centuries, those events are yes, historical, but in a grand scale, somewhat recent in memory. And so they are pertinent to the lives of the people that I was interviewing, and also, you know, in the religious and cultural heritage of those communities. So I think it's important to contextualize those. I also think it's really important to examine this in terms of the political narratives that the party puts out. And so the Communist Party's rhetoric on ethnic politics is one of harmony, inclusion, diversity. And if we're going to scrutinize those narratives, we need to sort of understand both the conditions that ethnic minorities existed in prior to the CCP, as well as the sort of relationships that the communities have had under the party's rule. And one of the things that the party has really emphasized and has been picked up by major media outlets, including famous and venerable Western publications, the New York Times, The Economist, a bunch of other notable journals of record, is that the Hui are China's, quote, air quotes, good Muslims, as opposed to the more frictional or conflicting relationships with Uyghurs. And I think part of what I was interested in doing is to demonstrate that, one, those narratives are very historically contentious and very recent, and also to kind of poke holes in that idea, because I don't think it has ever been really that representative of the relationship between the state and Islamic communities writ largely, but the Hui in particular.
Mm-hmm. And you give us a good sense of who the Hui are and where they live, and this sense that, yeah, as you say, they're often contrasted in official language, or at least from, especially by outside observers, too, with Turkic or other Muslim groups, not just Uyghurs and Kazakhs, but other Muslim groups who have a contentious relationship with the central state. And you give us some of that history that is often narrated about the Hui as sort of descendants of traders in past centuries, perhaps from the Middle East, and the kind of very integrated nature of this community across the country, identified by the center as a Chinese-speaking minority group, as opposed to those that have their own languages. Of course, that's not as straightforward as it sounds, which we will, I think, address in a bit. But you contextualize all of this really well. I wonder, though, you know, what it is that drew you to the kind of low-level, everyday, quiet moments, as you put it, of ethnic identification and Hui life, if you like, in the settings that you focus on.
I think this has been a longstanding academic fascination of mine. Maybe not even just an academic fascination, but the idea of how culture is a carrier for politics, and how culture is a way that politics gets expressed and interacted. So you mentioned briefly that this is sort of unusual for what we usually think of as political science, and I've always sort of thought that political science can and should care about micro-interactional moments, because these are the sort of quiet moments that we are talking about, that we reference in the book, are the things that lay the foundations for how people understand their sense of belonging in a community, who they are, what they are willing to mobilize for or become politically involved in. And even if these moments appear to be outside of organized political activity, they are not devoid of political significance. And so even in as a kid, and this is way outside of my realm of you know, academic study, but even as a kid, I was sort of interested in how things like food and performance and music informed our sense of our political selves. And I think the engagement with everyday ethnicity is my academic way of trying to understand how our cultural identities really do inform and influence our expressions of ethnic, national, political identities.
Right. And it's often those exact traits or a selection of them that are elevated by central state projects that want to celebrate certain components of ethnic identity. You know, again, cuisine and dress and so on are very popular ones. But I think what you do very deftly in this book is try to tease out where there are correspondences and divergences between those things that are kind of elevated by central state narrative about who the Hui are, and then how those things are reflected on by communities themselves. But onto those communities, I mentioned in the intro the four cities in which you conducted research. Why did you choose those ones? And what do you feel that you got that was a sort of common Hui experience out of them? That's a very large question, that second part. But yeah, what were your grounds for choosing the four that you did?
So I think to sort of bridge this question with the last one, you know, it is sort of inevitably the case that these identities and these practices are contested, and they are subject of negotiation and debate and interaction, and you know, they're dynamic and fluid. You know, this is very much embracing the sort of constructivist turn in the study of nationalism and ethnic politics. And so when I set up my study, a multi-sided study, I wanted to sort of reflect the diversity and heterogeneity of Hui experiences, especially because the Hui themselves are a group that, as we have pointed out previously, they don't have the same sort of foundational ethnic narrative as the party's other recognized ethnic minority groups. These are you know, communities that trace their lineages back to various roots in the Arabian Peninsula, ancient Persia, Central Asia, or more realistically, probably converts from Han communities that since have adopted these lineages themselves. And so I wanted to sort of showcase the ways in which diversity of both cultural heritage and also sort of geographic and demographic positioning really influenced how identity was contested and marked out. And as to sort of how these sites got chosen, I am a huge proponent, methodologically speaking, of doing pilot studies. I think, you know, going into a field site cold and trying to sort of understand what's happening on the ground is not necessarily the way that you would want to approach doing this. So I took a month pilot study in July of 2014 and basically visited all of these sites and a couple of others. I had brief interactions in Lanzhou and Lingxia and several other places that I wanted to try and explore the sites and see whether or not the kinds of phenomena that I was interested in looking at, the sort of urban transformation and the movement of people across space, was occurring in these sites. And so after a pretty thorough pilot study, I felt like this was a broad and diverse representation of Hui experiences throughout China, though obviously there are important experiences that I could not accommodate because of reasons of time and funding. And so, you know, obviously this is one view of these dynamics. And as for common experiences, I think not just in Hui communities, but in China writ broadly, one of the common experiences that came out of looking at ethnographic observations of urban centers is the experience of change and transformation that reorients traditional habits, practices, and expressions of identity in every community that I visited, in every community that I stayed in, from, you know, an East Coast city like Jinan to a part of China's Northwest like Xining. These forces of urban transformation, the change in demographics, the change in urban infrastructure, the remaking of urban space, was really altering the way that people had lived for the past 20, 30, 40 years, and that these changes were recontesting and reopening understandings of what it was to be a part of a community. And that I found fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's telling an important story about contemporary China at large, I suppose, because if there's one thing that people think a bit about China, one among a number of things, but the urbanization kind of story of the last few decades has been obviously a landmark occurrence, and lots of different people's negotiations with that are very important, I think, to consider. I should say too that, you know, the diversity of experiences you highlight, the way you kind of dissect these different locations, obviously the capital city, Beijing, where Hui live among a by far outnumbered by mostly Han, but lots of other peoples living in Beijing, in Jinan, which is almost exclusively a Han city, but with a small Hui enclave, in Ningxia, where or in Yinchuan, the capital of Ningxia, which is a Hui autonomous region, where Hui are, what, 30-35%, something around that. And then in Xining, where there's actually a much more distributed sort of multi-ethnic setting with Tibetans and Salar and other minority groups. So I think you give a really interesting spread there, and also highlight, you know, a kind of urban diversity, which might not always jump out at, sort of casual observers of Chinese cities, which, you know, I don't think it's too damning to say increasingly have certain resemblances these days, at least in terms of physical form. So I think that's a really interesting piece of insight. But onto that urbanization question, and the kind of negotiations of identity that you highlight, how is it, do you think, that ethnicity kind of is significant within urbanization? I mean, in so many ways, I think people of all kinds of different, you know, people have found their backgrounds, their previous experiences completely uprooted in China by the rapid pace of urbanization. So what is distinctive about Hui experience of ethnicity within this broader urbanization kind of process? I mean, are they not just dealing with the same things that everyone else is dealing, I guess, is the most rudimentary way of asking that question?
Well, I think it's important to say that Hui are dealing with the same things that everybody else is dealing with, and that's important to highlight, that these are not necessarily exclusive challenges to the Hui, but that the same dynamics that affect Hui communities about renegotiation of identity or competing understandings of community are, I don't want to say universal in China, but they are increasingly prominent, especially in urban communities. And so I think, you know, similar examinations of other ethnic communities or, you know, class-based communities or what have you would be similarly revealing. But specifically, I think for the study of ethnicity, there are some distinct advantages of looking at urban landscapes as opposed to others. In particular, urban landscapes become arenas for the contestation of different understandings of identity. So people from different places come together in urban landscapes. You are more likely to encounter people who are not from your ethnic community or people who have arrived from different parts of your ethnic community from throughout the nation, throughout the state. And so those spaces, those neighborhoods become these arenas for different understandings of how one embodies their ethnic identity, different practices, different traditions, different celebrations, different food ways, everything else. These are these interactive spaces where things come together. Also, in the case of Hui, and not exclusively for Hui, these patterns exist in other countries as well. You know, we note in places like the United States, there are ethnic enclaves in cities that establish ethnic networks and ethnic economies. We think of like the Chinatown model of an ethnic enclave as something that exists in the West and elsewhere. In Hui communities, there are similar ethnic networks because of the necessity of building up resources related to religious practice. So the way that this is commonly explained by people like Drew Gladney and others who did these foundational studies of Hui culture and who in many ways I try and build on their foundations, they explain that, you know, in Hui communities, a mosque is a central space around which businesses, social life, dietary habits are all formed. So the mosque and the marketplace are these centers of ethnic identity that are sort of perpetuating Hui identity through daily practice. And in that sense, because of these ethnic networks, these ethnic enclaves, there are great opportunities to see how Hui identity is perpetuated vis-a-vis a more visible other, whether that other is Han or Salar or Tibetan or what have you. And so I think exploring Hui identity in urban landscapes was important for that reason as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that makes plenty of sense. And I think a real kind of point of interest of this book is that you yourself are seeking to answer some questions about Hui negotiations of ethnic identity. And you point out later in the book that, you know, it's a sort of commonplace, I think you say, among kind of studies of ethnic politics, that anyone who goes out looking for ethnicity is going to find it, right? That might apply to anyone doing any kind of research projects, that if you think you're going to find something, you probably better find it. Otherwise, you're not going to you know, get your thing written and all that. But anyway, you mentioned that. But in a sense as well, of course, you're respondents, your interlocutors in these various locations are themselves looking for something, or, you know, that makes it sound a bit romanticized perhaps, but they are involved in negotiations. And it's mostly those internal negotiations that you draw out rather than committing yourself to any particular rigid definition of Hui-ness as, you know, as perhaps favored by certain party states we might name. So I just wonder if we get into those kind of negotiations, and we'll, you know, go into a bit more of the detail as we go through the chapters. What are the terms of these kind of debates? What sorts of things are Hui, I guess, themselves looking for? If that's not too simplistic a question, and how do those intersect with the categories promoted by the state?
Well, yeah, I think that this is a really important point to highlight here. I went into this study expecting that a lot of the identity marker, significant identity markers that I would find, the sort of negotiations and debates would be unfolding between Hui and the majority Han, or Hui and perhaps other ethnic minority groups in the case of Xining. I thought that there would be this us-them dichotomy. And one of the things that I found once I got into the field was that often Hui were far more interested in telling me about how they were different from other groups of Hui and how their version of Hui-ness was the sort of most realistic, the most representative, the truest form of Hui identity. And I think, you know, this is, again, a reminder for anyone doing fieldwork that once you get into the field, your project will completely change and you will just need to embrace that. But I think once I started pulling that thread, what I found most interesting was that all of these sort of discussions about what it meant to be Hui centered on a number of different conversations, like the level of devotion that you invested in practicing your faith, or the ability to speak the language of the faith, Arabic, Quranic Arabic, or ancestral dialects like Persian or Turkic languages or what have you. How able were you to do these things? Should you be able to do these things? Increasingly, you know, there were debates about how you observed a halal diet, or whether one needed to observe halal diet, or in some senses, whether you needed to do really anything at all other than to be registered as Hui, to be Hui. And so all of these different sort of conceptualizations of a very secularized cultural sense of I'm Hui because my ID card says that I'm Hui, and, you know, I identify as Hui because that's what my government documentation says, to a conceptualization that says, actually, I'm Hui, but more importantly than anything else, I'm a Muslim and I'm a practicing Muslim and I am of this Islamic tradition, and, you know, I observe these rituals, what have you. These were the kinds of debates that I was finding sort of hashed out, and they varied very intensely depending upon who I was talking to, what regions they came from, what their urban versus rural background was, whether they were sort of recently arrived in an urban context, what level of education, what kind of career path they had chosen. So, like, all of these different factors were very much at play in articulations of what it was to be a member of this community. And I wanted to really understand how those contributed to sort of a relationship with the state and its established categories. Because, you know, as with any other group, the Hui have this officially designated and very carefully spelled out set of criterion by which they are identified by the Chinese state. And oftentimes those did not align with what individual expressions of Hui-ness were.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right, right. And I mean, I think another strength of what you outline in describing some of those negotiations is an unstable relationship quite often, one that is not obviously resolved between terms like Hui and Muslim, like whether, you know, you note kind of asking people what the difference was, if there was one, and people not necessarily being able to commit one way or the other. Some people might not. But, you know, these categories are not always things that people, you know, willingly buy into all the time in the same way, even within one person. So I think being comfortable with that sort of unresolved quality is another important aspect of the kind of what you sort of draw out here. I think we've got a good sense now of sort of the contours of the book at large, and the story you're telling in many ways, I think, of a kind of, if you like, nested negotiation with a certain kind of urban modernity or something, which reminds me a bit of a comment I think anthropologist Andrew Kipnis made about China being a sort of world in which modernity and the world's modernity processes are sort of unfolding, because lots of the stories you narrate are redolent of kind of broader global scale negotiations by peoples and polities and groups with, you know, when confronted by kind of Euro-American modernity in previous times, or indeed ongoing negotiations. So I think that lends a real comparative interest to the work as well. Yes, we jump into chapter one now, and I should say that the book is divided into five chapters and a conclusion, which kind of dissect a variety of different dimensions of these negotiations, which we've already talked about. Your first chapter actually sort of zooms in a little closer to this state role. And I think that's, you know, that's important, not to have the state as a sort of boogeyman hovering in the background with all sorts of assumed agendas. You do actually go into some detail talking about the kind of state's own agenda and ethnic politics in the Xi Jinping era, as the chapter one is subtitled. So could you say something about the kind of party approach to ethnicity at large, the Minzu policy, right, this ethnic policy in the Xi era, and what are they trying to do, basically, I guess, is the question.
Yes. So for listeners who might not be familiar, China recognizes ethnic minorities via a system of classification and registration, which gives citizens one and exclusively one ethnic identity, Minzu identity. Minzu being a neologism that is difficult to translate, but is often sort of meant to mean ethnicity. And in the past, prior to the era of Xi Jinping, the way that China has regulated ethnic politics, it's kind of drifted back and forth between different poles, but there has been an attempt at a recognition of ethnic identity as a form of official diversity to showcase the regime tolerance and sort of multiculturalism, especially contrasting to perhaps previous eras of Chinese history. There have also been attempts to sort of promote official recognition of ethnic identity via preferential treatment policies, such as subsidies for maybe subsidies for religious practice for Muslims, for instance, for buying halal meat, or recognized holidays for ethnic minorities to celebrate traditional holidays, or the one that is almost always cited is extra points on your college entrance examinations and exemptions to the prior one child policy. So there was this broad network of preferential policies to sort of recognize ethnic minorities and promote ethnic identification education in attempts to sort of meld ethnic identity into a multicultural Chinese state. In the Xi era, there has been a sort of a revisitation of this project as the sort of post Mao era opening and reform has emphasized a sort of performance-oriented legitimacy in Chinese politics, in that the party claims legitimacy by being able to promote material advantage, material progress, economic growth. And increasingly, as China's economic growth has slowed a little bit from its white-hot peak in the early 2000s to a more steady and stable but diminishing economic growth, there's been a focus on stability, which is a far more nebulous and tricky concept than economic performance. And this stability takes a lot of different forms, including in ethnic politics. And stability in ethnic politics under Xi Jinping has meant, you know, sort of harmonious ethnic relations as defined by the state, and a sort of emphasis on the idea that all members of the Chinese system of nationalities, Zhonghua Minzu, this overarching Chinese national identity that the party is trying to solidify and construct, are equitable, that these shares of the prosperity that the party has brought are equal. But the problem, as I try and explore a little bit in the book, is that oftentimes when you examine day-to-day relationships, those narratives kind of fall apart a little, where you see daily instances of discrimination, be they sort of more microaggressive in terms of putting out ethnic stereotypes and sort of broadcasting about ethnic minority identities. In the case of Hui, it's usually some sort of cartoon version of Hui identity related to selling of ethnic foodstuffs, like the sort of nearly universal lanzhou la mian, the sort of beef soup noodles that you see vended all over China, or indeed the more aggressive and nefarious expressions of discrimination, which are calling Hui Muslims terrorists or associating them with ISIS or any of the other kinds of things that you might imagine, the Islamophobic reactions that occur all over the world. They also happen in China's relationships between Han and Hui. And so the dynamics of Han-Hui relationships, and indeed like Han-minority relationships during the Xi era, is this rhetorical commitment to diversity for legitimating purposes and a much more complicated picture on the interpersonal level.
Right, and actually that leads us very naturally into chapter two, which is the first of four chapters which deal with broad themes of choosing, talking, consuming, and performing as sort of vectors of Hui identity, or negotiations of Hui identity. So the choosing element is promoted, concerned primarily with marriage, or and also, I guess, the offspring of marriages, and how much the role of faith is emphasized when Hui choose a marriage partner. So could you say something about what is at stake when Hui get married, and what happens kind of both within and beyond the community? Is there an emphasis placed on conversion? You mentioned Han converts of past times, or perhaps people of other faiths converting. What's the kind of emerging picture of marriage, which I should say too, you know, is a key kind of urban phenomenon, because given what you already mentioned about the kind of collisions of people, different peoples within cities.
Yeah, I think that this is a really important puzzle to sort of figure out for a couple of reasons. One, because it is tied to official status of citizenship. So there is a definite pressure related to state identification and the receipt of certain types of state-associated benefits with being an ethnic minority that come attached to this. There are also cultural considerations from a more orthodox Islamic sort of understanding about what the role of faith in relationships ought to be, that is relevant in some Hui communities that are more pious, which emphasize that, you know, in order to join in union with an Islamic family, one must be a Muslim, and so conversion is necessary. And perspectives on this ranged across groups, and I would talk to people who were in sort of more secular or non-religious Hui households, where Hui identity was mainly a government demographic expression, or maybe a cultural one more than a religious one. And for these couples, the conversation about who one married and what that would mean for the status of one's potential children were matters of sort of self-interest, that proclaiming a certain identity would be important if this child of this mixed marriage would be receiving state-associated economic benefits, what have you. Did it pay to be officially Hui in a demographic sense? Was it important to receive those benefits? In more pious or more orthodox religious communities, the question about marriage and particularly childbirth were issues of continuing faith and culture. And there was a fear, I think a lot of respondents of mine expressed to me, that if someone married from outside the community of faith, then potentially their children would not be taught how to be Muslims. They would not be taught how to be members of this religious community, and they might secularize, and that might be detrimental to the survival of the community and also for the personal salvation, I guess, of the child. And so there was this taboo sort of against marrying outside the faith. But for instance, in Xining, where there is a significant population of ethnic Salars who live alongside Hui and practice Islam, there were notions that, marrying within the Islamic community, marrying a Salar, marrying a member of another Islamic minority group, was fine as long as that child was brought up, if you had children, that the child was brought up to be Muslim. So these are these sort of competing pressures. And I think that makes these choices about citizenship and marriage of particular importance. It's also important that, and I think this is something that I didn't quite get to delve into at the length that I wish that I would have in the book, but this is also something that places a lot of pressure on women in particular as being the bearers of culture and responsibility for the bearers of identity. And so these become really gendered choices as well, in the sense that in many cases, the pressure to choose correctly is greater for women than it is for men. And that is a real important thing to sort of highlight there.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, that kind of it's a lot of very deft intersectional, I think, discussion that you conduct throughout the book, and questions of gender, of class, and as well as ethnic and religious identification, all are kind of rendered in ways that, again, I think are not easily resolvable or kind of easily packageable or categorizable. And again, I think that's something that is interesting and thought provoking about the book itself. The next couple of chapters that deal with language, particularly Arabic language, but I guess also, as you mentioned, Persian and other specific linguistic uses by Hui communities, and then also consumption and diet and foodstuffs. So I wonder actually if we might approach those two chapters through a sort of almost terminological angle. As I've said, the state identifies the Hui as a Chinese-speaking minority, right, or a Chinese-speaking minzu. In terms of the sorts of terms that Hui use to discuss language that they might use that is distinctive to them, there are two kind of key ideas, it seems to me, one of them being Jingwen, and then this other kind of more encompassing or perhaps nebulous idea of Hui Hua. So could you say first perhaps what Hui Hua might be or is, literally means sort of Hui speech, right, or Hui language, but the state says that doesn't exist. So what's Hui Hua?
Well, it's not even so much the state says that doesn't exist. It just isn't even on the state's radar. A Hui Hua is sort of a very locally determined kind of thing, where each Hui community has a local dialect, just as they would have a local dialect of Mandarin or whatever language, in the Chinese language family is predominant. And a lot of people explained it in different ways. That, there were some people who talked about a Qinghai Hui Hua in Xining, or there was an imam in Beijing that I spoke to who talked about how there was a Beijing Hui Hua that, in his words, you hear it, he would tell me, you hear it when we do the call to prayer. It sounds like, singing Beijing opera. It's very localized. And when you sort of dig into these roots of linguistic ancestry in these communities, you find that they all have very localized origins, and it very much depends upon who the Muslims that entered into the community to be the original sort of core of the community were. I was talking to a colleague of mine in Jinan about this, and I was sort of asking him, one of the major sort of expressions that we find this sort of Hui Hua taking place in is the idea that there are specific surnames that are attached to transliterations of Islamic names that have been adopted by Hui communities. And of course, they differ from place to place. So there is the universal Ma is Muhammad, usually understood to be Muhammad. And then there are a couple of others that get brought up, but there are many others that are less specific to globalized Islam and more rooted in a particular community. Like in Jinan, Fa is a common Hui surname. And when I was asking my friend about this as well, you know, that's from Fatola, which was the name of a Turkic general who occupied the city during the Yuan dynasty and blah, 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 blah. And it really highlighted for me that this was a very localized dialect that people sort of would speak. Now, like many other localized dialects, you know, Hui Hua is declining. So people don't speak it anymore, or not with the same level of proficiency, because of language standardization, because of the promotion of Putonghua, because of secularization, because of all kinds of other things. And so, you know, this sort of idea of a localized Hui speech particular to each Hui community that borrows loanwords from Persian or Turkic or Arabic is something that increasingly is becoming, you know, a feature of the past.
Mm-hmm. And you also identify a number of particular, I guess, circumlocutions or sort of modes of expression that avoid perhaps or circumvent direct use of terms like die and kill and certain sorts of terms lodged within Chinese that are also sort of specific modes of speech, which, you know, again, not to harp on endlessly about this sort of theme, but sort of defy in some senses a kind of neat categorization, a sort of taxonomy. Jingwen also interested me as a topic. I guess it's the sort of scriptural language, if I've understood that right, and the often heavily sinicized version of Arabic that is used for religious purposes among Hui communities who may actually not really speak or understand Arabic for itself. And also, I think when you write Arabic in Chinese characters, as with any language that with a different syllabic form, it renders it extremely different. But it was interesting to read about the way that is distinguished from Arabic, Alaboyu, the language of Arabic-speaking countries as a contemporary kind of language in the world. And again, you know, with the overarching theme of urbanization, you identify very neatly, I think, the negotiations that have to go on where the decision to learn Arabic or a scriptural language often is seen to come at the expense of learning other things that might advance your career, and, you know, the eternal conundrum, I guess, of the sort of modern urbanized minority subjects in China, or indeed anyone seeking to preserve ethnic identity at the expense of other things. Chapter 4 brings us on to the title of the actual book, which seems an odd thing only just to have mentioned 45 minutes in. I guess, can we take a similar approach to Qingzhen, this idea of, well, literally, I guess, character by character, pure and true? How is this word used? What does it mean? And what does that say about what's going on in Hui communities?
Yeah, so Qingzhen is one of those terms that I think has multiple meanings depending upon what level of academic discourse you want to dive into. On a practical level, for most Hui throughout China, Qingzhen is halal. Just in an everyday application of the term, Qingzhen is a transliteration of halal. And so we talk about Qingzhen food, right? Qingzhen shipping. Or, you know, Qingzhen restaurants, you know. But on a more sort of deep level, Qingzhen is pure and true. It is an expression that often sort of encapsulates what it is to be Muslim, to observe Islamic custom. And so Drew Gladney calls Qingzhen the core of Hui identity, that Hui ethnic identity is centered on expressions, varying expressions of pure and true. Maris Boyd Gillette does a similar explanation of this. The way that I encountered it most often was people talking about their dietary habits, and eating Qingzhen is, like many other things, the sort of spectral understanding of what it means to maintain a halal diet. Everything from some of my friends who are more secular. I have a very long time friend in Jinan who understood Qingzhen to mean essentially when I go to eat with friends or at a restaurant or when I cook at home, you know, I don't eat pork, but everything else is okay. To other Hui who would tell me that that's absolutely wrong, that Qingzhen is about making sure that everything that you use to cook the food is ritually clean, and that all of the foodstuffs have been, especially meats, have been prepared in a way that has been blessed by an imam, and there are these ritual cleanliness practices. So there's this like broad range of understandings of what Qingzhen means. And one of the most fundamental disruptions in this, aside from, you know, what level of religious oversight does need to be prepared for the food, is alcohol okay to have? Because, you know, alcohol, abstention from alcohol is one of the principal sort of command, you know, fundamental axioms of Islamic faith, according to the Quran. But, you know, Hui all over China do drink alcohol. Some of them, you know, some of the communities say that alcohol is, you know, just a thing that we consume. And it's these competing understandings of whether that disqualifies you from saying that you are really practicing Qingzhen. This is especially true in places like Jinan and Yinchuan, where you have these thriving industries of particularly shaokao, barbecue, and that are almost exclusively run by Muslims, by Hui. And in Jinan especially, the Hui Quarter is a place where you go to eat yang rou chuar, where you eat lamb kebabs, and drink keg beer late into the night. And not only do people partake in this, but they benefit from the sale of it. And so there's this contentiousness built around, well, is that really acceptable for good Hui, good Muslims to do? And then you see, again, we have this interaction of, you know, Hui as a cultural and ethnic identity versus this overriding religious identity that says, actually, as Muslims, we should not serve alcohol. We should not serve, you know, things that would be considered unclean. And in Xining, by contrast, you still have a thriving barbecue industry, but people in Xining would tell me, you know, if we served keg beer alongside our yang rou chuar, no one would ever come to patronize our restaurants. We'd be shut down within a day. So it's this really interesting contrast. I mean, what level of scrutiny are you paying? And part of the reason for this is as well, which I kind of note in the book, and there are like ethnic entrepreneurs with an agenda to try and regulate and standardize this, because there is no real standard nationally for halal certification. And that leads to all kinds of ambiguity that filters down into communities. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you mentioned a particularly kind of amusing, perhaps tongue-in-cheek remark by someone you met running a bar, which he identified as Qingzhen, despite obviously its main product being alcohol. But Qingzhen, in this sense, meant, as far as I recall, kind of clean, pure, fresh alcohol, and also real, genuine foreign alcohol. So this is a particularly stretching the boundaries of
that was a particularly interesting character. Is a man who wore a giant jade Buddha amulet around his neck, and it was very much not a Muslim, was not Hui, but was Han in Yinchuan, and thought, this is a way that I can bring in business, and went as far as to put not just the character's Qingzhen, but like the Arabic for halal on the sign of his Qingzhen Jioba. And when we asked him, what does this mean to you, or what do you think that it's okay to be doing this? He seemed very unconcerned and actually not even really aware of why that might be controversial.
Right. No, extremely, extremely creative and interesting is one thing you could say about that. I wonder, as we kind of get towards the end of our time, I mean, I might move over chapter 5, and we'll come back to the kind of ritual and actual, you know, Islamic practice, if you like, worship and so on, because I think that has relevance to sort of something of the contemporary situation. But in the conclusion, there's actually plenty that's sort of new in the conclusion, or kind of, you know, doesn't just summarize what's gone before. So I wonder what you describe there is a kind of overall process between these internal negotiations that we've discussed a bit today, and how that intersects with, again, this state sort of emphasis, this state message about ethnic identity. How do you see the dynamics playing out then between these internal negotiations among Hui people that you identified right the way back at the start there, concerns over secularization or kind of generic urban identity, and the state and its own interests?
Well, so first of all, I think you've highlighted something that must have driven my editors crazy. So Steve Harrell is someone who deserves a lot of credit for not losing his mind for seeing that there is a bunch of new ground covered in the conclusion and thinking, what is this guy up to? So patient editors, thumbs up for patient editors. In response to the sort of summarization by reintroducing these dynamics, I think when you pull back and you look at the contestation that occurs over the different aspects of Hui identity, what we observe is really a relationship where the processes of development, the processes of modernization, the processes of urbanization, the movement of people from west to east and from rural to urban and all of these interactions, what it does is it sort of channels. It channels contestation in a way that diffuses tension with the state. And one of the hallmarks of authoritarian governance is that you try to, you know, avoid overt suppression where you can. Suppression is costly, it backfires, it may mobilize resistance, and what you don't want to do is you don't want to harden dividing lines between groups that might form interests against the state and the state. And so, you know, in most situations, China's ethnic governance is trying to channel ethnic politics in a way that focuses contention inward. It focuses on these debates about, well, what does it really mean to eat a Qingzhen diet? Or what does it really mean to, you know, practice Islam in the correct Arabic, or to marry correctly within the community, or what have you. These are all debates within the community that don't contest the state's definitions because they are busy sort of hashing them out on these intersecting lines of class, of education, of region, of profession, of gender. And if you can do that as an authoritarian state, you diffuse tensions. You shove to the side these potential challenges to state authority. It's when those boundaries harden and the lines become clearly defined, the community against others, and others in this case would be a Han-centric state-building project from China, that's when you have friction and resistance that disrupts these narratives of legitimacy and stability and, you know, good governance by the party. And so the party's objective over the last several decades has been to neutralize this kind of contestation by channeling it inward. And this is not just something that happens in Hui communities, it happens across ethnic minority communities within China, but it also happens in any number of different areas, right? Authoritarian channeling is a broad practice that the state undertakes. And, you know, in a lot of ways, the state has been successful in creating a situation where it neutralizes resistance to its ethnic policies by affecting these sort of channeling practices. So the situations we see with, you know, Uyghurs or Tibetans, where there is that sort of organized resistance, mobilized resistance, is often sort of an exception rather than the rule. It's something that James Liebold talks a lot about in some of his work in ethnic politics regarding Tibet and Xinjiang.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And well, I mean, I suppose where that channeling and that desire to kind of get just differences, you know, hashed out internally. One very interesting thing about that, of course, is to look at how much urban life, how much urban, I guess, in James Scott's idea, legible communities suit the Chinese Communist Party, you know, whose origins and whose early sort of career was so avowedly rural and agrarian. So that kind of, you know, practice is certainly something that says something interesting, I think, about the party. As a final question, and one over which I think the party hovers also considerably, I wanted to get back to, you know, your chapter, which deals with faith and ritual and worship. Seems odd in a way to only have come to that now, but because it's so resonant with more recent developments. I wondered if you could say something about the place of that within these kind of longer term negotiations, and then what's happening, you know, among the communities that you did fieldwork with since, you know, since you did the fieldwork and under the more the sort of harsher, stricter regime that has emerged in recent years.
This is a really important question to highlight, I think, because there is a sort of pre-2016 reality and a post-2016 reality that are important to note. So Hui Islam has always been sort of accused of or contested about these ideas of indigenization of Islamic practices, syncretism, and sort of this divergence from Islam that occurs in the Arabian Peninsula or the Middle East or what have you. A good friend and colleague of ours, Ryan Thumb, talks about how this is sort of an inappropriate way to think about Islam, so that there is no syncretism because there is no such thing as a pure form of Islam. But where Islam has adapted to localized traditions in China, there are these debates over where they're like Sufi practice of remembering saints in a sort of formal ritualistic practice that to some people takes on elements of Taoist or Confucian or what have you. Localized practice is acceptable, or whether Muslims ought to sort of embrace a more reformist, Middle East oriented version of Islam. And so in the Hui communities that I observed, there was this question of what was a sufficient level of devotion. You know, did one need to wear a headscarf every day? Did one need to wear a prayer hat? Did one need to pray five times a day? Did one need to pray weekly or pray at all? You know, these were all kinds of questions that kind of came up. And even among religiously devout communities, the question was sort of, did one need to practice a more traditionalist Islam, which was almost always posed as, you know, this sort of reformist Islam from the Middle East, or was it okay to be a Chinese Sufi to practice these, you know, localized Islamic practices? So there were all these different levels of contestation. But what this really highlights for me when we look at the present situation is that increasingly the Chinese state has become hostile to expressions of faith that come from outside of China. And so anything that would be foreign or would bear the influence of a non-Chinese tradition is labeled as suspicious and labeled as potentially dangerous, potentially destabilizing. And in particular, this is true of Islam, which is often depicted in Chinese media as this sort of binary between you have this international Islam, which is associated with terrorism, with ISIS, with religious fundamentalism, and you have a localized Chinese Islam that is managed by the party state and is patriotic and whatnot. And what we've seen since I left the field in 2016, especially in Uyghur communities, and I want to be very clear here that the things that are happening in Uyghur and Turkic speaking Kazakh and other Turkic speaking communities in what China calls the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, what others call East Turkestan or the Uyghur homeland, these are on a scale and a level that is completely different than what is happening to Hui communities. So you have credible evidence of Muslims being detained in concentration camps, held indefinitely, going through all kinds of human rights abuses and whatnot. So I want to be clear to note that what's happening in Hui communities is not on that scale, but within Hui communities we see an increased effort to sinicize or to oversee the expression of Islam. Xi Jinping in 2017 and his address to the Party Congress says that all religions in China need to be Chinese in orientation. And what that means for Hui communities is that, you know, the religious practice needs to be sort of informed by party values, that mosques and places of worship need to exhibit native Chinese architectural styles, that Arabic is being downplayed as a textual language in a visible sense in Hui spaces, that all these kinds of efforts to stop what Xi Jinping calls extremism or Islamic fundamentalism, which is really should be read as foreign Islam, are intended to increase synoptic control By the party state. So that's kind of the situation we find ourselves in now, where the sort of once approved practices of multiculturalism and diversity are increasingly running up against these urges to sinicize, control, streamline, and otherwise oversee expression of religious faith, even in Hui communities.
Right. Well, yeah, and that does, I think, bring us up to the moment and roughly to the end of our conversation with some very important stuff to conclude there. So thank you very much, David. You've taken up some of your time today, but before we let you go, would you like to say something about what you're currently working on, whether it's an expansion of this project or a complete departure, or what have you got in the pipeline?
I think in many ways it's not a complete departure. It is an attempt to kind of expand this conversation. Obviously, right now, with the current dynamics of global pandemic still sort of dominating access to the field, and also these subjects becoming increasingly sensitive, like field work in China is becoming challenging. So I am trying to carry on my observations of this kind of relationship in a way that may be observed remotely. So I've turned to the subject of online Islamophobia, looking at how global tropes of Islamophobia, ones that are derived from perhaps the U.S.'s global war on terror or from paradigms that are established in relations between the Middle East and the West or other dynamics, are replicated in China and are enacted in Chinese social media commentary about Muslims, and how this leads to understandings of what Chinese identity is understood to be and is talked about and how Muslims fit into that. And increasingly, I'm also interested in the idea of sinicization, which kind of dovetails with this, sort of tracking and understanding the political and social goals behind sinicization as this leads to continued political outcomes. So these are kind of where I'm looking for the future.
Great. Yeah, well, those sound like excellent expansions and developments of what is a very solid basis and a highly recommended book for really anybody, I should say. I think in a perhaps arguably non-halal fashion, a pint awaits us. So I'll say, David, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast, and it's been great speaking to you.
It was a great pleasure, Ed. I really appreciate it.
Listeners, thank you too for listening, as ever, to New Books in East Asian Studies. It's a podcast channel on the New Books Network, and it will be back with you again very soon. Goodbye.